Case number 07-1438. The Rockies Fund, Inc., et al., petitioners versus Securities and Exchange Commission. Mr. Meehan for the petitioners, Ms. Smith for the respondent.
Right. Petitioner.
May it please the court, if I may reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. Sometimes it is about the principle. Mr. Calandrella is with me here today, and we've returned to the court on this case. The reason we are here now concerns the sanctions that the SEC has determined to impose. We are no longer here arguing about liability, but we are talking about a situation where even after all this time, we firmly believe that the government still has not complied with its obligation. The government has not explained in an understandable, coherent, consistent way the rationale behind the sanctions that they have determined to impose in this situation. The government suggests that we should be grateful that the last time we were here, this court reversed in part and affirmed in part, but vacated all sanctions. And the sanctions today, compared to the sanctions the commission originally determined to impose, are very different. But so is this case. When this court reversed the SEC last time, the overriding point of that opinion was that the government must explain the rationale behind its decision making. If there was a determination on that record as it was being returned to the commission that sanctions were appropriate, this court made clear, as so many cases have, and this is not a unique principle, it's obviously a fundamental part of administrative procedure. It was made clear that the agency needed to explain the rationale. There is among the things that are missing in the now two additional opinions, because we did seek reconsideration on the original opinion that came out. So now, I guess if you look at it, a total of four opinions from the commission concerning this case. We have not been able to find a single sentence that addresses a question, which is, what is the basis for imposing new and additional sanctions after this case was sent back? When the case was sent back, it was in a somewhat unique posture. Mr. Calandrella had already been barred for 27 months, as had Mr. Tigas and Mr. Powell, and they, along with the fund, were under a cease and desist order for 27 months at that point. The commission, although we raised it repeatedly, the commission never addressed that fundamental point in the unique.
What about footnote 36? It said the time that the prohibitions were already in effect is to be counted towards the 3 and 5 year prohibitions we impose today.
Understood. Your Honor, maybe I should be more clear. What I'm getting at is not that we haven't been given credit. That the credit has been given in the new bars. And in fact, I guess as of today, since those bars were reimposed, there's now approximately 4 years that they have been in place. So credit is being given in a mathematical sense. But what I'm getting at is there was no discussion of why in the circumstances of that case or this case at that time for deterrence or remedial effect, a signal to the industry, there was no real analysis of why there should be further sanctions. Then when we turn to the issue that I think is implicit in that footnote, which is what is the right length of a bar or what is the right length of a C&D or something of that nature, we're not here to quibble with the agency over did they hit the bullseye. We understand that the agency has a substantial amount of discretion in setting a particular sanction once they follow the legal standards. But our issue and our concern is that they are not complying with the law in terms of articulating some of the rationale, and in other ways, they're departing from the record. The fundamental basis for the sanctions at this point is that after a period of, I guess it's 14 years now, where it was never contested, never argued, and everyone seemed to concede, and I believe we cited a number of references in the record to this effect, that there was no actual harm. The fundamental underpinning of the Commission's decisions now is that there indeed was harm. But the harm is an abstract one. It is that there was a harm to the marketplace that by the false disclosures that were made here concerning this tiny security in the faux jewelry business, Premier Concepts. The argument is that those disclosures affected the integrity of the market, that they created a substantial risk of substantial loss to others in the market. And that's an interesting point as well. In the government's briefing, they focus on it and they quote it as a substantial risk of substantial loss, singular. The statute actually speaks in terms of substantial risk of substantial losses, plural, to other persons, plural. What we're getting at by pointing out that distinction is that the Commission here seems, in our view, to be trying to reach beyond the statute, trying to reach beyond the facts, and establish a principle that would take agency discretion beyond the point where there would be any bounds. They are essentially arguing that a tiny fund with very few individuals involved, to whom, with all due respect to Mr. Calandrella, no one was paying any attention, somehow the mistakes and the inappropriate actions that took place there were creating a risk of substantial losses, plural, throughout the marketplace.
Can't the Commission focus on the kind of behavior at issue and talk about the kind of behavior being problematic and having harm as a general matter affecting the integrity of the markets? Can it generalize out from the kind of behavior? You're not saying the behavior was appropriate.
Correct. We're not saying the behavior was appropriate. And in fact, Your Honor, that seems to be where they have gone, is to say that there were these generalized effects on the market. But our point is that you can't speak in the abstract of a theory without having one of two consequences, and we think both are present here. One consequence is that the rule begins to subsume the exception, so that if in the case of this tiny fund, the misstatements that were made here have the kind of effects on the market that Congress was envisioning when they said that there would be a substantial risk of substantial losses, then it's hard to imagine a situation where you would not have that result.
The significant risk of substantial loss standard, doesn't that apply for third-tier sanctions?
Yes, it does.
And these were not third-tier sanctions.
It is our reading of the opinions that the Commission views this as a third-tier case.
Would you agree that if you're wrong about that is, if these are in fact not third-tier sanctions, then this argument you have fails?
With respect, no, for two reasons.
Yeah.
One, the opinion reads clearly, in our view, that they started with a third-tier analysis and then exercised discretion to make it a second-tier case. But if you start too high, you end up too high. That's why they ended up in the wrong place, I guess, if you will. And secondly, there's no justification for the particular level that they end up with because of the improper starting place.
This was all in a footnote when they said that they thought it fell. I mean, looks to me like what the Commission was doing here. I mean, in this footnote, they're saying, I mean, it looks like they're sort of, you know, that's addressed to us. They're saying, okay, you reversed our third-tier sanctions. We still think they were probably okay, but we're not going to do them. And they didn't do them. They didn't do third-tier sanctions here.
Well, I'm sorry.
So, and since they didn't do third tier, they did second tier, then that higher standard that you're citing for the commission doesn't seem to apply.
I would suggest it does apply when you look at the way they analyzed it. In effect, they imported that standard into the public interest test. They found and say repeatedly, and of course their briefs are full of repeating this as well, that there was this harm, and that is the principal underpinning upon which they determined in the public interest that new additional sanctions were needed. So whether they are, you know, confusing the test or simply, as we read it, attempting to expand their discretion, they have based the decision in large part upon that finding, and on this record, that finding cannot stand. We also have identified areas where, under the cases that have traditionally been examined, in which the government repeats are appropriate. When you consider other factors for imposing sanctions, whether you should, and if so, to what degree, there are certain factors that they have not taken into account or which are at odds with the record. As an example, the whole business of reliance on counsel. We understand at the liability stage we advanced that, and that was not a successful defense to liability. But under the Blinder Robinson case and others, the relationship with counsel can and should be taken into account at the sanction stage. Here, what we have in essence have said is that the lawyer who helped these people come to the understanding they had of what they were supposed to do, watched them fail. Now, he testified he thought they did it right. He wrote a policy that he thought made sense, and he watched them implement it at some of their meetings. They did it wrong, and he was wrong. And so they were found liable. But he watched them fail. Very similar with the auditor. The point there is not about second-guessing what the valuations should have been or any of those other issues, but the record is clear that the auditor was charged, at least with the year-end 10-Ks, with examining issues of classification, and in 1995 had a discussion with Mr. Calandrella concerning a particular valuation. What the government has suggested is they don't need to take that into account because we needed to demonstrate that all material facts were discussed between the auditor and Mr. Calandrella. That was an argument that, of course, came up, you know, only in a recent briefing. The only material fact we can think of that they must be speaking to is that whether the security, which was thinly traded, was restricted or unrestricted. By the time of the 1995 10-K and the conversation that took place between the auditor and Mr. Calandrella, the auditor was well aware that the security had been improperly classified and was indeed restricted. And as it's reflected even in the commission's opinion in the final case about the auditor, the commission was chastising the auditor because in his notes he wrote down that the valuation was appropriate. Why? Because he thought, the auditor, that it was akin to a private sale. Again, this is not about whether Mr. Calandrella and the others at that tiny fund did it right. They did it wrong. The question is, what do you do with them after they've already been barred for 27 months, et cetera, and on what basis under the law do you articulate the appropriate legal standard so that people in their situation will understand what they should do and what will happen if they don't follow appropriately? It's the same point, again, about the involvement of the government 40s Act examiner. The 40s Act examiner came to the fund, spoke to Mr. Calandrella, and then 4 years later was the first witness at trial, and he testified to the essential practical criticism that this court found and that the commission found as well with the way Mr. Calandrella was leading that board on this valuation question. Mr. Calandrella was making ad hoc determinations and presenting those to the board, and there was very little discussion. That's how the examiner relayed the conversation at trial. That is the heart of the practical failure here, is that there were ad hoc judgments being made by Mr. Calandrella, and the board accepted them. And our reference to that is not to suggest that there's any argument of estoppel or any of those things that have come up at this point. It is simply that it would be appropriate under the standards of the cases that the government should take that into account. But with the lawyer, they say, you know, there was no evidence that they followed his advice, but he was there and watched them fail. With the auditor, Well, we think maybe the auditor didn't know the material facts, but he did know the material facts, as their own opinion about him concluded. And with the government examiner, they say we don't think that matters, but they don't address our fundamental point that Mr. Calandrell was wrong. He had every reason to think at the time that he was right. And we think that should be taken into account, and the government disagrees. And that's where we have our disagreement on that point. One thing as well to speak about briefly, the government takes the petitioners to task and has obviously fashioned its sanctions upon our constant reference now for a decade to the Parnassus case. Now, we may all have disagreements over whether the Parnassus case was rightly decided or wrongly decided, but the government has had two different approaches to this. Approach number one was no case guides another in agency practice. So we don't have to explain why we did what we did in Parnassus and why we're doing what we're doing here in the Rockies Fund. And in a sense, there is some truth to that. But it at the same time was something that now Chief Justice Roberts was able to reconcile when he addressed the case concerning the FAA, that he addressed the principle that came out of the Butts case, which was that an agency need not follow as strictly rules of precedent, may not, you know, be bound to having the exact outcome case by case, but as Judge Roberts indicated in his opinion in the FAA case, but if you depart, even in an adjudicative context, from an approach or a principle, it is incumbent upon the agency to explain. And we think, actually, the government agrees with us that they have the burden to explain, because I mentioned they had two postures. The second posture is, for a decade now, they've been trying to explain why Parnassus is different and why Mr. Calandrella should be barred under the current iteration of the sanctions for 5 years from the industry, for example, in addition to the other punishments. And at one point, they said, well, it has to do with the conduct was very different, the mental state, the intention. There was fraud here. There was no fraud in Parnassus. That's what they said in the first opinion that came out that's before the court now. When we pointed out that the mental state and the finding in both cases was recklessness, then the government came back with something that I can only respectfully refer the court to their briefing, because I've read it and I don't understand it. They have said, well, it wasn't the mental state, it was the nature of the violations. And I'm not sure what they're getting at. But what it is clear is that after a decade of us banging on this case and asking for a distinction and the government agreeing that they need to explain it away, they haven't. And so we think in that sense, too, they are violating the types of standards we would expect. The government has a lot of discretion in terms of setting sanctions, but it can't get away from the obligation to explain its rationale. And we think that's ultimately so much of what the problem is here today.
All right. Do you want to reserve the rest of your time?
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Leslie Smith, and I represent the Securities and Exchange Commission. Let's just start with Parnassus, since he left off with it. The direct answer to their question of why you shouldn't compare Parnassus sanctions with those in this case is that the Supreme Court has held that a sanction is not invalid because it is more stringent than the sanctions in other cases. And this circuit has also said that the commission does not have to do comparisons of its sanctions, so we will not do them either. When this court vacated all the sanctions and sent them and remanded to the commission, it directed the commission to explain what sanctions it might impose for those violations that had been approved by this court. And that's what it did. Now, this opinion is full of descriptions of all the factors that are necessary, what it looked at, how those factors.
What's your response to the argument that the commission, in fact, started with the third tier and worked down because
it
supported the third tier standard?
Yeah. It's inconsistent with what the commission said it did. and there's no clue in the opinion that would suggest it. The commission didn't do a third-tier analysis at all. It didn't even speak about third-tier sanctions. And the higher penalties don't just come from like a third tier. As you recall, the multiplying that was done by in the last set of sanctions will raise the sanctions tremendously, so that Calandrella's current second-tier $50,000 sanction could have been $400,000 had the commission multiplied.
What they were arguing was that under the third tier, the commission relies on this factor of significant risk of substantial loss to others or resulted in substantial pecuniary gain.
Well, I have studied that.
And that's not part of the second tier.
And so I've studied their accusation, and I don't believe it's true. The only thing they cite for it is they cite the sanctions order, page 13, and it's a sentence that begins with, as discussed above. But if you go backward through the opinion, there is nothing discussed above that relates to the substantial loss. The commission certainly did not incorporate it into its public interest factors. Well, if it had, it would have discussed them.
What I thought they were referring to is that in part three of the commission's opinion, and at the joint appendix 152, there's a whole paragraph about serious harm to investors in the marketplace.
Oh, are you talking about where they say that the third tier would apply to petitioners' activities?
And then on the next page, they say, once a public interest determination is made, a third tier establishes. I thought that's what they were referring to.
I have never figured out what they're referring to because
well,
I don't
see it. Well,
let's assume
that's what they were referring to when they said C above.
Well,
I mean, why is all that discussion relevant?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't have that with me. Maybe I should go grab it. I believe that the description, it's a sentence and a footnote of why the petitioner's activity created a significant risk of substantial loss. And that is dictum. It never went anywhere. The commission decided and indicated very clearly that it was using second-tier sanctions. That, in a sense, is sort of an academic commentary. So it's not reasonable to...
In other words, would you say that the way to read the commission decision is to go back to 151, where the commission has that conclusory sentence saying the commission respondents' actions were at least highly reckless, and then it goes on to describe the basis for that conclusion?
So I'm sorry. I'll have to go get it.
Why don't you?
I'm sorry.
See if you can turn to 151.
151.
And you see the first full paragraph. First full paragraph, first full sentence. At least highly reckless. Do you see that?
Yes, I do.
Then if you turn the page, there are these following paragraphs. Now, is it your view that what the commission was doing was simply describing how it reached the conclusion of recklessness?
No, Your Honor. You're talking about the commission's discussion of, among its public interest factors, of the notion that dissemination of false and misleading financial information causes serious harm. That whole discussion is about harm. Harm often appears in the factors that the commission looks at in order to determine this kind of thing. And this is... It doesn't have any of those cue words that they've placed in it. It's not about a third-tier sanction standard. It wouldn't make sense in the commission's public interest factors.
Well, I understand your point. I think their argument is that when you get to the commission's own description of the tiers, all of that discussion is only relevant to the third tier. Now, maybe they're wrong about that, but I thought that's what their argument was.
I'm sorry, I'm not. Because, of course, the second tier, which they chose, is one that involves fraud, deceit, manipulation, and reckless disregard of a regulatory requirement. And that's already been found in this case and is very appropriate. I thought you were talking about something that the commission said, as I said, in a sentence and a footnote, that describes their belief that this, that the petitioners could have a third-tier case.
No, I'm talking about the body of the analysis.
And the pages again?
The very ones you're looking at, 151 through 153.
Well, I know that the words about significant risk do not appear in that section. And it's about, it's quite different. It's one of the harm factors that's being discussed in the commission's decision whether or not to bar. It's a description of a public interest factor. And it really does not include, petitioners have foisted that phrase into the argument, just as Judge Tatel said. They've put it in, but it doesn't come from anywhere. It just makes trouble for everyone. The commission only spoke of that one in the place where it said that they thought that the behavior could be a third tier, but that they were not going to impose it.
Anything further?
Pardon?
Anything further you wish to argue to the court?
Oh, well, there were lots and lots of things, but I gather that many of them have already been gone over by your honors. That I would like to stress that the petitioners are the ones who put that phrase about loss into large portions of their briefs, and it doesn't occur in the commission's opinion that, in fact, that whole discussion of those three pages is about the harm that comes from what they did. And it's not hypothetical. Real harm comes when you have false and misleading information that's disseminated. The investors need accuracy so they can make their decisions. And if once people find out that it's been disseminated, it erodes their trust in the market. These are things that come from the commission's judgment and experience, and they've said it before, just as this court has said it before in the Dresser case. And it's quite a different, I mean, the commission will stand by that in every way. It's quite a different thing than the misnomers that seem to have been entered into the fray. Does the court have any questions?
No, we'll take your argument under.
Thank you very much.
We'll hear from petitioner.
Thank you, Your Honor. We didn't put those words in there. Yeah, that's the point the counsel made, is that the petitioners put this in. We just read the opinion. And when we weren't clear about some parts of it, we asked for reconsideration and we tried to get it clear. And if you look at the opinion and then the opinion on reconsideration, this whole question of Parnassus and what it means and what the standards are for sanctions just gets more and more muddled. There are pages and pages, and Judge Rogers, you pointed out the heart of it. That Section 3 focuses heavily on harm. It's about harm. And the commission is trying to make the case that these failures in disclosure by this microscopic fund involving a few people about a security that nobody except the folks in this room have ever heard of, by and large, and I'm exaggerating, but for the effect that this didn't have an impact like Dresser, this isn't a Fortune 500 situation. You know, it isn't Merrill Lynch or Lehman or anything else that does dominate, you know, the attention of the market, you know, today. The commission is of the view that this is a third-tier case. And they were reacting, and I think Your Honor suggested it. It was perhaps written in part for this court. They were sending a message back that they see this as a situation where they don't want controls at all, and there have to be certain controls over the discretion that an agency has. And in this case, they have found that there is always going to be significant harm from any failure of disclosure, and it was a top-down situation in this case. They explained for pages why there was harm, and then they said, but in our discretion, we'll start with Mr. Calandrello at the top of the second tier, rather than independently examining it by the way the standards of the cases and the statute would require. And we think that's why we've ended up here with a very muddled and confused opinion that, with due respect, even counsel had difficulty interpreting with all of her expertise and experience.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.
Stand, please.